Far away in a small mine at Copperhead, Mylog Chirrison, the cobbler, put down his hammer and tacks. "Look here, my boy," he said to his son, who was leaning on his workbench. "I've heard what you have said about the Grags being the salvation of dwarfs, and this morning I found this. It's an iconograph of me in Coombe Valley, the last time. Oh, yes, I was there. Nearly everybody was there. We'd been told by the Grags that the trolls were our enemies, and I thought of them as nothing more than nasty big lumps of rock out to crush us. Well, we were all lined up facing the buggers, and then someone shouted, 'Trolls, put down your weapons! Dwarfs, put down your weapons! Humans, put down your weapons!' And there we stood, and we could all hear other voices in different languages, and right in front of me there was this bloody big troll, oh my! He had his great big hammer ready to pulverize me. That was not to say that my axe wasn't about to take his bloody knees off at the same time, but the voices were so loud that everybody stopped and looked around, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he said, 'What's happening here, mister?' And I said, 'I'm damned if I know.' But I could see the other side of the valley, and there was a great big kerfuffle between the top brass, all screaming about dropping our weapons. And I looked at the troll, and he looked at me, and he said, 'Are we going to have a war or what?' And I said, 'Oh, and I'm pleased to meet you. My name is Mylog Chirrison.' And he sort of grinned and said, 'They call me Smack, and I'm pleased to meet you.' And all around us, people were wandering around and asking one another what the hell was going on, and were we fighting or were we not fighting, and if we were fighting, what were we fighting for? So some of the lads sat down and lit a fire for a brew-up, while at the other end of the valley the flags were fluttering and everybody was walking around like it was a holiday or something. And then a dwarf came out to us and said, 'Good fortune, lads. You're going to see something that no one else has seen for millions of years.' And we did, I reckon. We were some way away from the front of the queue because trolls and humans and dwarfs were coming back out of the cavern, and every single one of them, going past us, looked as if he'd been hypnotized. Now, I've told you about the miracle of Coombe Valley before, my lad, but you haven't seen this iconograph of me and Smack. Just took at the time, just after we realized we weren't going to be fighting that day, and we all went in ones and twos into that cavern and saw the two kings, the King of the Dwarfs and the King of the Trolls, entombed in shining rock, playing thud. And we saw it. And it was true. They'd been friends in death, and that gave us a signal that we needn't be enemies in life. And that was it, until later Smack and me tried to find something both of us could drink. A lot of the people were doing the same thing, but the potion he gave me nearly blew my bloody head off. It certainly made my boots burn. Smack has got two kids now, you see, doing all right, working in Ankh Morpork. Trolls ain't all that good at writing, but I think of him and I think of Coombe Valley every day." The old cobbler looked sideways at his son's face and said, "You're a smart boy, smarter than your brother was, and I reckon you've got a question to ask me." The boy coughed and said, "If you saw them playing thud, Dad, can you remember which one was about to win?" The old dwarf laughed. "I asked that when I met Commander Vimes, and he wouldn't tell me. We reckoned he probably broke a few pieces off so no one knew who the winner would be, so some curious little fellow like you wouldn't go off and try to start the whole damn war again."
"Commander Vimes? The blackboard monitor?"
"Yes, it was him all right. Shook my hand. Shook both our hands." The boy's tone was suddenly reverential.
"You actually shook hands with the actual Commander Vimes?"
"Oh, yes," said his father nonchalantly, as if meeting the famed blackboard monitor was all in the day's work. "I suspect you have another question, my lad."
And the boy frowned. "So, Dad, what's going to happen to my brother?"
"I'm sorry, I don't know. I sent a petition to Lord Veterinary saying that Levelis is a good lad who got into bad company, and I received a reply, and his lordship said that a young dwarf set fire to a clax tower while people were working on it, and his punishment will be at his lordship's leisure. And so I sent him another letter, saying that I had fought at Coombe Valley, and I received another reply, and his lordship said that he understood that I didn't fight at Coombe Valley, because fortunately nobody did. But he understood that I must do what I can for my eldest son, and as his lordship said, he will cogitate." The old dwarf sighed.
I'm still waiting, but as your mother says, while we're not hearing anything, then he's still alive. Now don't tell me, my lad, that the Grag extremists are on our side, because they ain't. They're the ones that'll tell you that the dead kings have been made up in Ankh-Morpork and were dummies, and so were we if we thought they were real. And, my boy, the dumb believe it. But I was there. What I touched I felt, and so did everybody else on that day, and that's why I get angry when the Grag start preaching about the horrible humans and the terrible trolls. They want us to be frightened of one another, thinking there must be an enemy. But the only enemy now is the Grags and those poor fools like your brother who set fire to a Clax tower and got badly burned for his trouble. They are the victims of the sneaking bastards in the darkness. Far away in the oblong office, Drumknot put the midday edition of the Times in front of Lord Veterinary and looked down at Mr. Cheerison's latest frantic petition, saying, "They've torched two more Clax towers, my lord, but so far no one has died. Except on their side, of course. Young dwarfs badly advised. They should have known better." The silence enveloped Lord Veterinary. "Indeed," said his lordship. "But it is easy to be an idiot when you are 17, and I would warrant that the Grags who put them up to it are much older. There is no sense in breaking the arrow if, by acting sensibly, you may capture the archer. I'll leave the Cheerison boy thinking about his fortune in the Tanty for a while, and will make a note to have him brought over to talk to me in a month or two. If he's clever, his parents won't be grieving, and I'll have a number of names, and above all, the goodwill of his parents. Always worth thinking about, don't you agree, Drumknot?"
"Damage to property," said Drumknot speculatively.
"Yes," said Lord Veterinary. "That's it." A few days later, Crossley quietly entered the master bedroom of the house in Schoon Avenue, nudged Moist, and when that had no effect, finally pinched his ear in order to get his attention. He whispered, "Excuse me, sir, but his lordship requires your presence at the palace immediately, and I am sure that neither of us would like to see the mistress troubled at this time, yes?" At home, and for once in bed at the same time as Moist, Adorabelle Dearheart was gently snoring, although she was certain that she did not. Moist groaned. It was the crack of 7, and he was allergic to the concept of 2 7 o'clocks in one day. Nevertheless, he dressed with a speed and silence trained by experience, walked noiselessly downstairs, left the house, and got a trolley bus to the palace. He ran up the steps to the oblong office, reflecting that, day or night, he had never seen it empty. This time Lord Veterinary was at his desk, looking, if the word could be applied to Lord Veterinary, chipper.
Good morning, Mr. Lipvig. Rather speedier than last time, yes? Now I imagine you haven't had time to look at your newspaper today. Something rather droll has happened."
"Is it something interesting to do with the railway, perhaps, my lord?"
Lord Veterinary looked puzzled for a moment and then said, "Well, there is something, yes, since you ask." He sniffed, as if what he was dealing with was not, in the great scheme of things, all that important, and continued,
"I am being told that everybody is going to Harry King's compound to see the marvel of the steaming train, which seems to have caught the public fancy. I understand that Sir Harry, with his usual business acumen, is already turning this into a commercial enterprise."
"Of course, that is news. But when you do, indeed, get hold of a newspaper, you might notice a small apology from the editor of the Times to the effect that the crossword has been removed, as the compiler is stepping down for a while owing to the pressures of keeping up the standard of achievable games that are nevertheless sufficiently taxing."
"Of course, as a rule I do not gloat, but I fear she has met her match. I shall ask Drumknot to arrange but a box of chocolates to be sent to her from a secret admirer. After all, I am generous in victory."
Lord Veterinary cleared his throat again and said solemnly, "Alas, Drumknot has taken the morning off to go and have another look at the engine."
"The morning off? Who ever heard of such a thing? I have to say that I am somewhat surprised, as the only other time he has ever requested time away from my service was to attend the Paperclip, Stapler and Desktop Aid Symposium 3 years ago. He got very excited about that one, too. One wonders what the attraction of this engine can be. Does it not seem rather strange to you? Moist was a little nervous of the use of strange and Drumknot in the same sentence, and instead volunteered to visit the site of the train to escort Drumknot back to the palace. Since you will be there, Mr. Lipwig, I shall be pleased to hear your impressions on the economic opportunities for my city. Aha, thought Moist. So that's why he's dragged me out of bed. Again. Nothing to do with the crossword, nothing to do with Drumknot, but everything to do with his city getting an interest in the railway. His lordship gave Moist a brisk nod and waved the paper, suggesting that it was time for him to be on his way. It took Moist a long time to push his way through the throng, anxious to see the modern miracle of the age. Harry King's business compound was at the very end of the queue that seemed to straggle halfway back to the city. There was no sign of Drumknot, but Moist wasn't surprised. When Drumknot was standing in front of you, he was so retiring as not to be there. There were guards on the gates all round the compound, Harry's own and City Watch, watching like hawks, as one by one the citizens queuing up parted with a whole dollar at a time to ride behind the locomotive. And a dollar was a dollar, possibly a day's food for a family, and yet, as far as Moist could ascertain, flying over the rails on the wonderful train was worth tightening your belt for. It was better than the circus, better than everything to be speeding along with the wind in your face and black smuts that made the eyes water, but were, well, the badge of the train riders, who nevertheless didn't seem to notice it, given the amount of unpleasantness that could slap, splat, spit or fly into your face when you stepped into the street, or even when you walked into your own house, if you lived anywhere near the shades. Moist was well versed in the people of Ankh-Morpork's love of novelty, and he had to admit it, Iron Gerda, pulling her train like the queen she was novelty in the extreme. She came trundling around the corner, with people in the carts behind screaming and waving to friends still waiting in the queue. And as a connoisseur of the madness of crowds, he watched carefully, and noted that some passengers disembarked and scuttled away to the man who was handing out little tokens in exchange for another dollar, and then ran all the way to the back of the very, very long queue for another go. There was a click nearby, and then a flash, and he turned to see the perennially cheerful face of Otto Schriek, lead iconographer of the Ankh-Morpork Times, who gave him a friendly wave. "Well now, Mr. Lipwig, surely you're behind this in your cheeky little way?" Moist laughed and said, "No, not me, Otto, but it's very popular, isn't it? And I want to be at the very centre of it all," he said to himself. He noticed that periodically the man collecting the money hurried away carrying huge leather pouches, with a troll bodyguard fore and aft, and was instantly replaced with another showman ready for the monies of the mob. And so Moist, as he told himself in his own cheeky way, followed the money. He followed it in between the great noisome heaps and stinking lagoons of Harry's empire, until the man with the large pouches of coin walked into a large shed. He followed him inside and froze, because he was immediately surrounded by the kind of men who have their noses splashed against one side of their face, little in the way of conversation, and, he noticed now, very bad halitosis. Fortunately, the shed also contained Sir Harry, who was bright enough to wave a hand in the air and say, "OK, boys, loose no sphincters. It's only Mr. von Lipwig, my old chum and bank manager. He's practically one of us, ain't you, Moist?" Moist grinned, thankful that sphincters were, right now, not in play, and said, "Well, now, Harry, you know, as your bank manager, I of course make it my duty to look after your interests, and I gather that you're looking after the interests of Mr. Simnel, too." That hung in the air like a sickle, a sharp one at that, and he watched Harry's face, which hadn't moved one single muscle. And then, abruptly, Harry burst out laughing and said, "Oh my, Mr. Lipwig, I always said you was a sharp card, and if it comes to that, a card sharp." He nodded to his bodyguards and said, "Go and have a little break, lads. Me and my old friend here will be having a little chinwag, such as old friends do. Go on, bugger off, a lot of you." And indeed they did, all except one, the very largest, a troll who glittered strangely and was watching Moist most intently, but not as intently as Moist watched him. And, Moist thought, the troll was a gentleman. He couldn't think of him in any other way, He was well-dressed, which was remarkable in itself, as most trolls viewed clothes as optional. Somewhat embarrassed at this interest, Moist felt rude enough to say, "OK, Harry, but there's one bodyguard still here. Do you think I'm going to try anything?" Harry King guffawed.
"That Mr. Lipvig is my lawyer. His name is Mr. Thunderbolt. Got the letters after his name and everything, ain't you, Thunderbolt?"
Lawyer. Bingo. Harry was laughing all the way from his belly now and said,
"Mr. Lipvig, the look on your face. Don't worry, though. Mr. Thunderbolt takes everybody that way. That isn't to say I ain't glad to see you, but you could be of service to both me and our friend the engineer. Shall we go somewhere a bit more private? Coffee?"
Harry waved at a clerk, who bustled away swiftly, and then ushered Moist and Thunderbolt up to his office overlooking the compound. Harry sat down and beckoned to Thunderbolt and Moist to do the same.
"Now then, you know me, Mr. Lipvig, like I know you. We're a pair, eh? Not exactly crooks, not exactly. Well, not now, anyway, because we've grown up and know how to do business properly, don't we?" he concluded with a wink. "And we both know a once-in-a-lifetime deal when we see it, I'm sure. Tell me if I'm wrong, yeah?"
There was somebody who was a lawyer in the room, moreover a lawyer who could presumably kill you with one punch, and it was always worth thinking about anything that you were going to say in front of a lawyer, because you never knew if you really could trust the weasels. But Moist nodded at Mr. Thunderbolt and said, with careful diction, "Sir Harry, Lord Veterinari has set me the task of assessing this wonderful new invention on behalf of the city." Harry King opened a box of big cigars, sniffed them, and chose one before proffering the box to Moist and Thunderbolt. The troll declined, of course, but Moist was never one to turn down one of Harry King's finest cigars. They came from far-off places and were truly excellent. Harry puffed out a big cloud of smoke, leaving him for a moment looking just like Iron Girder, and it occurred to Moist that Harry, who knew that symbols are important, was definitely hoping to be the first railway baron.
"Mr. Lipvig, Iron Girder is peacefully, for want of a better word, transporting eager citizens around the track regular as clockwork. Round and round they go, happy as you like, you must agree. Mr. Simnel says he built her as a proof of concept, and he needs a lot of money to build a full-sized version that can pull even more people, and above all, freight, because he reckons that's where the money is to be made, although looking out of the window at all those smiling faces, I'm not so sure of that."
Sir Harry sent another plume of smoke into the air and looked smug, which, Moist considered, was probably the case, before adding,
"Since I know you, Mr. Lipvig, and I know that you can read me, yeah, I'm prepared to bankroll a lad in exchange for a slice of the profits, a big and fair slice. I understand that he's now all but skint, totally boracic, with the arse nearly out of his trousers. And if he's ever going to get his ambition to run bigger trains to here, there and bloody everywhere, then he needs a partner with experience of the world. And I have that experience from the bottom up, as it were. But you know how it is, gents. When a man gets older and he's made his pile, he starts caring a bit more about what people think about him. So I ain't no dwarf. I won't steal an advantage on a young man with prospects. That's why I'm happy to say that with the help of Mr. Thunderbolt here, I've struck a fair deal with the young lad. Ain't that so, Mr. Thunderbolt?"
The air seemed to glitter as the troll stood up, shimmering as he spoke. His voice appeared to come from twilight canyons far away. It wasn't just sound, it had a presence in its own right.
"Yes, that is so, Sir Harry. I suggest now that even though you have a handshake deal with Mr. Simnel, there should be 3 shares in this enterprise, to avoid deadlock, with the 3rd and very small share in the hands of the city, to wit, Lord Veterinari. The purpose of the arrangement is in case Mr. Simnel and you, Sir Harry, are unable to agree on a matter connected with what we are all calling the railway. Lord Veterinari will have the casting vote to end that deadlock. But the city will not take any dividends. Its income will come, as always, from straightforward taxation,
which I am sure Lord Vetinari will consider an important part of this enterprise. The small print will be a little more complicated, and of course, if Mr. Simnel's locomotives catch on, there will be opportunities to sell extra shares in the future. If you both agree, gentlemen, I will deal with that aspect, and you may be certain that in compliance with Sir Harry's instructions, Mr. Simnel and his family will have a significant share in the business.
As slowly as he had stood up, Mr. Thunderbolt sat down again, and Moist von Lipwig and Sir Harry King looked at one another.
Harry, beaming, said, "I suppose I'd better get the lad in, then," and nodded to Thunderbolt to open the door.
A few minutes later, Dick Simnel sat uncomfortably in his seat, trying not to make anything greasy, without much hope and even less success. Harry appeared not to notice and said cheerfully,
"Now then, lad, it's like this. You reckon that with enough money you could make engines larger and more powerful than iron girder, right? And with long enough rails, you could get to all the other cities? Well, lad, I'll bankroll you in this enterprise until you're in a position to prove that this is possible."
He stopped talking for a moment, looked at the ceiling, and said,
"Tell me, how long do you think that'll be?"
The engineer looked thoughtful and somewhat baffled, and said,
"I couldn't rightly say, sir, but the more the money jingles, the faster the wheels will turn. I mean, if I can hire the best skilled workers, and well, sir, I've made my calculations, done a lot of testing, and I reckon I could have a new engine ready for—"
Moist held his breath.
$1,000.
Moist glanced at the face of Harry King, who flicked the ash from his cigar and said, in a deadpan way,
$1,000. "And how soon can you have it on the rails, lad?"
Simnel took his small sliding device out of his pocket, played with it for a minute or two, and said,
"How about 2 months?
He fiddled with the device again and added, "Around tea time." Moist was fidgeting at this point, and he chimed in with,
"Excuse me, I know you said that Simnels have been working on steam for years, and that other people might have been too, but do you know if anybody else has anything like this? Might they steal a march on you, even if they don't have your secrets?"
To his surprise, Simnel said cheerfully,
"Oh, yes, sir, about 4 or 5 of them, but none of them have produced even a working concept like the Iron Girder. They're making old mistakes my dad did, and making a few others of their own and all, from what I hear. Superheated steam doesn't give you a chance. Get it wrong, and it'll tick flesh off your bones. Now me, sir, well, I'm a stickler for measurements. Tiny, teeny, weeny measurements. They ain't very exciting, but that's the soul and centre of being an engineering artificer. Unfortunately, my granddad and my dad were a bit slapdash about them, seeing as they didn't have the proper knowing of them. But measurements is your saving grace if you want to raise steam. Me mum paid for me to get a better learning, being as her side of the family had money from—" he paused— "fishing. And one of my uncles made theodolites and other delicate instruments. And I thought to myself, well, this is very helpful, especially when he taught me how to blow glass. And what I need glass for is me own little secret."
Simnel looked anxious for a moment and said,
"I'll need a shed load of iron, especially for tracks themselves. And, of course, then there's the question of laying tracks through people's land. Someone will have to talk to the landowners. I'm an engineer, always will be, and I'm not sure I know how to haggle with the big knobs."
"Ah, as it happens, we have a born haggler with us right now," said Harry. "What do you say, Mr. Lipwig? Do you want to be a part of it?"
Moist opened his mouth to speak.
"There you are, then, young Dick. We'll use Mr. Lipwig for any negotiations. He's the kind of man who'd follow you into a revolving door and still come out in front. And he speaks posh, when necessary. Of course, he's a bit of a scoundrel, but aren't we all in this business?"
"I don't think I am, sir," said Simnel cautiously. "But I know what you mean. If you don't mind, I'd like to suggest that my first track is laid all the way back to Stolat. Well, not exactly Stolat. It's a place on the outskirts called Swinetown, there being so many pigs in the area. That's where the rest of my gear and machinery is stored."
Simnel looked nervously at Sir Harry, who was pursing his lips.
"It's a long way, lad. Must be 25 miles or more.
and you'd be right out in the sticks there."
Moist couldn't hold his tongue.
"Yes, but they wouldn't be the sticks for long, would they? Try and get fresh milk in the city. It's always bad cheese by the time it gets to you. And then there are things like strawberries, watercress, lettuce, you know, everything with a limited shelf life. The areas that have the railways will be more prosperous than those that don't. It was the same at first with the clacks. Everybody said they didn't want the towers, and now anybody who's anybody wants one at the bottom of their garden. The post office will be on your side too, moving the mails faster and all that. I can assure you that the Royal Bank will be right behind you, and indeed, Mr. Simnel, I'll invite you to join me in my office as soon as possible to discuss our special banking facilities."
Harry King slapped his thigh and said, "Mr. Lipwig, didn't I say it? You're a man who sees an opportunity when it's in front of him."
Moist smiled. "Well, Harry, I think it's in front of all of us now."
In fact, in his mind's eye, Moist could see lots of opportunities and plenty of room for problems, and here, right in the middle of it all, was Moist von Lipwig. It couldn't get better than this. His smile widened, inside and out. It wasn't about the money. It had never been about the money. Even when it was about the money, it wasn't entirely about the money. Well, it was slightly about the money, but most of all, it was about what the dwarfs called the crack. The sheer pleasure about what you were doing and where you were doing it. He could feel the future catching him up. He could see it beckoning. But of course, sooner or later, someone would try to kill him. That usually happened, but you had to take the chance. It seemed to be a necessary part of the whole thing, whatever the whole thing actually was. You always had to take the chance. Any chance.
Harry gave Moist a sideways glance and said, over his shoulder, "Mr. Simnel, if you've got a lot of your valuable stuff in a shed up there in Pig City or wherever, would you mind me sending a couple of my,
Harry paused, seeking for a genteel wording,
"my useful gentleman to keep an eye on the place for you?"
Simnel looked puzzled and said,
"It's really a quiet old place, sir."
Harry moved into what might be called his avuncular persona and said,
"That might very well be so, my lad, but I think that you and me are going to a place where there'll be a lot of money, and where there's a lot of money, there are a lot of people trying to take it off you. I'd like to think that if anyone broke into your big shed to fossick around for any interesting bits of machinery or clues as to how you build your engines, they might find themselves having to explain their interest to Snatcher, Stiletto Dave and Grinder Bob. They're all good lads, kind to their old mums and wouldn't hurt a fly. Call it, well, call it insurance. And if you can be good enough to let them have a key, I'll send them up there right now. Mind you, if you can't find a key, I'm sure they'll find their way in. They're very versatile in that respect."
Young Simnel smiled and said,
"That's very thoughtful of you, Sir Harry. Perhaps I should give them a message to take to my mother. She'll show them where everything is. My dad said always put a few nasty little booby traps around the place before you lock up. And then, after that, out they can steal from you, they're welcome to, if they've still got their arms to carry it away, that is."
Harry laughed out loud and said, "Sounds to me like your old dad looked at things just the way I do. What's mine is mine, and what is mine is me own." When Moist and Mr. Thunderbolt stepped out into the compound, Moist saw that people were still queuing up for a ride on the train, which was waiting like a queen while Mr. Simnel's lads filled her bunker full of coal and oiled and greased everything again, including themselves. They tapped her wheels and polished everything that could be polished, once again including themselves, while just about every little boy in the city, and amazingly most of the girls, stared at her in awe, worshipping at her shrine. And then it came back to him. Earth, air, fire and water, the sum of everything. The goddess had found her worshippers. There was a sound like thunder, but it was only Mr. Thunderbolt clearing his throat to say, "Remarkable, isn't it, Mr. Lipwig? There appears to be what one can only call a presence of sorts, a hint, as it were, that life turns up in many different guises, perhaps. Just a passing thought."
Moist had never heard such clear diction from a troll, and it must have shown because Thunderbolt laughed, saying, "A touch of diamond does the trick, Mr. Lipwig, and I will endeavour to draw up contracts that suit all parties. You need not worry."
Just then, Moist beheld Drumknot,
greasy and cheerful and covered with smuts, stepping off the engine and regretfully handing a hat and a very grubby jacket to one of Mr. Simnel's lads. Moist grabbed the little secretary by one arm.
"Where did you get to, Mr. Drumknot? I've been looking for you everywhere," he lied. "His lordship is expecting you back any time now."
Moist wasn't sure he liked Drumknot, but it wouldn't do to have him as an enemy, being so close as he was to the engine that drove Ankh Morpork. And so he cleaned up the little man as best he could and flagged a coach back into the city, noticing, as they travelled along the busy towpath, that the major traffic was still going the other way. Moist knew about the Zeitgeist. He tasted it in the wind, and sometimes it allowed him to play with it. He understood it, and now it hinted at speed, escape, something wonderfully new, the very bones of the land awakening. And suddenly it seemed to cry out for motion, new horizons, faraway places, anywhere that is not here. No doubt about it, the railway was going to turn coal into gold.
"Excuse me, young man." Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobby Nobbs, who had taken it upon themselves to patrol the line of expectant sightseers queuing for a ride on the train, looked around uncertainly. It had been a long time since Sergeant Colon had been a young man, and as for Nobby Nobbs, although it was generally agreed that he was the younger of the two, there was some doubt about whether the term Homo sapiens could be applied to him. The jury of Ankh Morpork was out. Colon and Nobby were supposed to have been on the beat in the shades, but Colon had delegated that task to a couple of new recruits.
"Good experience for them, Nobby, and it's likely to be a dangerous business, this streaming engine. Need someone to have a look-see. A couple of experienced coppers, let's say, prepared to put themselves in harm's way for the public good."
"Young man, excuse me," came the voice again. The speaker was a harassed-looking lady with two boys at heel, who weren't at all at heel and were expressing their frustration at having to wait for the promised ride on the train in the supremely annoying ways that only small children can manage. In a desperate attempt to distract them from their contest to inconvenience as many people in the queue in front of them as possible, their mother had seized on the first official-looking people who might be able to entertain her offspring with some interesting facts.
"We were wondering if you could tell us how this locomotive goes," she asked.
Fred Colon took a deep breath.
"Well, missus, there's the boiler, you see. It's like a kettle."
This was not enough for the smaller child, who said,
"Mum's got a kettle. That doesn't go anywhere."
His mother tried again.
"And how does this boiler work?"
"Well, you see, it sends the hot water to the engine," said Nobby hurriedly.
"Right," said the lady. "And then what happens?"
"And then all the hot water goes into the wheels."
The elder boy looked sceptical.
"Really? How's that done?"
Nobby, cornered, said,
"I think the sergeant can tell you that."
A little bead of sweat appeared on Colon's face, and he was aware that the two children were looking at him as if he were some kind of exhibit.
"Oh, well, the water is magnetic, right, because of all that spinning," he said.
The elder boy said,
"I don't think it works like that."
But Colon was on a roll and ignored him.
"The spinning causes the magnetism, and that's what makes the water stick in there. Lots of iron in train wheels stands to reason, and that's what keeps the train on the iron road, magnetism."
The smaller boy changed tack.
"Why does the engine go chuff?"
"That's because it's chuffed," said Colon with a sudden flash of inspiration. "See, you've heard of chuffed. That's where it comes from."
Nobby looked at his friend in admiration.
"Is that why, Sarge? I never thought of that.
And when it's had enough of a chuffing, there's enough magnetism to hold the train on the iron road, see?"
The last phrase was delivered in a rush in the hope that no more questions would be forthcoming. But it doesn't work like that with children. The elder boy had had enough and decided to show off the knowledge gleaned from friends who had been there earlier in the day.
"Isn't it to do with reciprocating motions?" he said, with a glint in his eye.
"Ah, well, yes," blustered Colon. "You've got to have your reciprocatory motions to get the right kind of chuff. And when everything is chuffing and reciprocatoring, away we go."
The smaller child was still puzzled, as well he might be.
"I still don't understand, mister."
"Well, perhaps you're too young to know," said Colon, taking refuge in the excuse used by exasperated adults through the millennia. "Very technical stuff you're chuffing. Probably shouldn't even be trained to explain it to children."
"I don't think I understand it either," said the mother.
"You know clockwork," said Nobby, coming to the rescue again. "It pretty much goes like clockwork, only bigger and faster."
"How's it wound up?" asked the boy.
"Ah, oh, yes," said Colon. "That chuffing noise, of course, is the winding up. And when it's wound up, then off it chuffing goes."
The smaller boy held up a clockwork engine and said,
"He's right, Mum. You wind them up and away they go."
Bemused, the lady said,
"Right, well, thank you, gentlemen, for a comprehensive little talk. I'm sure the boys were fascinated."
And she handed Colon several coins. Colon and Nobby watched the happy family as they climbed onto the cart behind Iron Girder. And Nobby said,
"It's a nice feeling, isn't it, Sarge, being helpful to people?"
Moist's cab halted at the palace, and he helped an exhausted Drumknot up the stairs. Amazingly, he was beginning to feel sorry for the little chap, who was looking like a lotus-eater who had run out of lotuses. Moist wondered whether it should be low tea, but thought, well, what the hell? Moist very carefully knocked on the door of the patrician's office, which was opened by one of the dark clerks. The clerk stared at Drumknot and looked askance at Moist, as Lord Veterinari himself stood up in surprise, leaving Moist impaled between two askances. So he saluted smartly and said, "I beg to report, sir, that Mr. Drumknot, very gallantly and fearlessly, and at some personal cost, has helped me form an opinion as to the practical aspects of the newfangled train, risking his life repeatedly in so doing, and for my part, I have seen to it that your government has a suitable measure of control over the railways. Sir Harry King is funding further research and trials, but personally, my lord, I believe the new railway will be a winner. I'm convinced that this prototype can pull more stock than dozens of horses. Mr. Simnel seems to be very thorough in his work, extremely meticulous, and above all, the people appear to have taken the train to their hearts." Moist waited. Lord Veterinari could outstare a statue and make even a statue start to feel nervous and confess. Moist's counter was a fetching grin, which he knew annoyed Veterinari beyond measure. And there was absolute silence in the oblong office while blank stare and cheery grin battled it out for supremacy in some other dimension, which ended when his lordship, still staring fixedly at Moist, said to the nearest dark clerk, "Mr. Ward, please take Mr. Drumknot to his rooms and clean him up, if you would be so kind." When they had departed, Lord Veterinari sat down and drummed his fingers on his desk.
"So, Mr. Lipvig, you believe in the train, do you? It certainly appears that my secretary is impressed. I have never seen him so excited by something that wasn't written on paper. And the afternoon edition of the Times seems to be in agreement with him."
Veterinari walked over to the window and stared down at the city in silence for a moment and continued,
"What can a mere jobbing tyrant achieve in the face of the even greater multi-headed tyrant of public opinion and a regrettably free press?"
"Excuse me, sir, but if you wanted to, you could shut down the papers, couldn't you? And forbid the train and put anyone you like in prison, yes?" Still staring down at the city, Lord Veterinari said,
"My dear Mr. Lipvig, you are clever and certainly smart, but you have yet to find the virtue of wisdom. And wisdom tells a powerful prince that firstly he shouldn't put just anyone he likes in prison, because that is where he puts the people he doesn't like. And secondly, that mere unthinking dislike of something, someone, or some situation is no mandate for drastic action. Therefore, while I have given you permission to continue, the train does not have my wholehearted approval. Neither does it have my curse."
The patrician seemed to consider for a moment and added, "Yet." He walked up and down again for a second or two, and then, as if the thought had only just struck him, said, "Mr. Lipvig, do you think it a possibility that a train could, in fact, get all the way to, say, Uberwald? That journey is not only extremely slow, tedious, and uncomfortable by coach, but it is fraught with many
perils and traps for the unwary traveller." He paused and added, "and indeed the unlucky bandit."
"Oh, yes, that's where Lady Margalotta lives, isn't it, sir?" said Moist breezily. "But it would mean negotiating the Willingness Pass, sir. Very dangerous up there. Bandits have been known to knock out coaches by throwing down rocks from the crags."
"But there is no way without a very lengthy detour, Mr. Lipwig, as you probably know."
"In that case, my lord, I think it might be possible to construct such a thing as an armoured train," said Moist, inventing furiously. He was gratified to see that Lord Vetinari brightened when he heard that, repeating the words "armoured train" once or twice more. Then his lordship said, "Can it really be possible?" And in the squirrel cage of Moist's mind he thought, "Can it? Can it really? It must be more than 1,200 miles. It takes well over 2 weeks by coach, and that's if you don't get hijacked. But who was going to try to hijack an armoured train? The engine would be wanting water frequently, and is it possible that it could carry enough coal for the whole journey?" The numbers rolled in his head. Stopping places, troughs for water, mountains, gorges, bridges, marshland. So many things, any one of which could scupper the project. But going to Oberwald would mean passing through so many other places on the way, and all of them could be opportunities to make money. The demons of critical path analysis swarmed around his brain. There was always something that you had to do before you could do the thing you wanted to do, and even then you might get it wrong. To Vetinari, he said cheerily, "Well, sir, I don't see why not. And, of course, for such a long journey, it should be possible to sleep on the train, and for heads of state to occupy a complete suite of carriages, if not the whole train. Surely that could be arranged?" Moist held his breath. After a few seconds, his lordship said, "That would be appropriate, but, Mr. Lipwig, I am not entirely bribed. The train must prove itself both financially and mechanically. However, I look forward to its success. It seems, Mr. Lipwig, that you are using your extra cheery voice, and so once again you find yourself in your own chosen environment, that being the centre of everything. But tell me, where do you think will be the destination of the first commercial train? Quern?" "Actually, sir, that has been discussed, and it looks as if it's going to be Stolat, because that's where Mr. Simnel has his machine tools and a large stock of materials that he would need to transport to Ankh Morpork. Besides, that place is a nexus for the Stow Plains, and nexus means..." Lord Vetinari raised a hand and said, "Thank you, Mr. Lipwig, I do know what a nexus is."
Moist smiled and headed for the door, showing his panic only on the inside, and as his hand reached the doorknob, Vetinari's voice behind him said, "Mr. Lipwig, you surely realise that a thoughtful prince, a prince who wishes to keep his throne for some time and is shrewd in the ways of people, would not travel in a thrilling armoured train. He would put somebody else on that train, somebody expendable, having himself travelled the previous day in a suitable disguise. After all, there are such things as very, very large boulders, and most definitely there are a great many spies. But I shall consider your idea. It has a beguiling ring to it."